Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 21st, 2017. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, our last interview from our trip to Minneapolis for HomebrewCon. Steve Wilkes and I visit with two of the founders of Fair State Brewing Cooperative. We talk about their interesting business model and sample delicious hoppy and sour beers. And of course, get tips on how to brew them. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and our other brewing gear, basic brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and click on our associate ad on the right-hand side of basicbrewing.com. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support there. And we have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com. And we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And you've apparently figured out how to find us. So, and if you'll do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, that'll help new listeners find us. And finally, if you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. For the third week in a row, a hurricane is topping the news along with a major earthquake as well. Maria is pounding Puerto Rico as I record this, and Mexico City has been slammed by a major tremor. Our thoughts are going out again to those who are affected in those areas. Mother Nature is certainly not being kind lately. Back here at home, we're doing okay. Steve Wilkes of Steve's Brew Shop and I got together and shot three videos this week. Two were episodes of Basic Brewing Video, one of which should be up by the end of the week, so look for that. And the third was a video for Steve's YouTube channel. In that video, Steve starts a sizer and on camera there in my kitchen and walks us through the process of getting that going. Meads and sizers are super fun and easy to put together. That should be posted soon, too. So I'll let you know about that through social media if you follow me there. Since this past week's show, I started another kombucha and beer experiment. This time, I combined finished kombucha with beer wort to mimic the effects of kettle souring. So, but I'm not sure how it's going to turn out because I was having problems with my pH meter. I couldn't get it calibrated. I think I was using old calibration fluid or something. I don't know what was going on. So I think I got the wort too sour for the beer yeast. So stay tuned for more info on that. I have high hopes for that. Maybe a quick shortcut into kettle souring, which is already a shortcut for sour beers. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Mark from Bellevue, Washington writes, enjoyed the recent Sessions podcast. Thanks, Mark. That was a conversation with Jennifer Talley, who has written a book on brewing session beers. Mark says, one thing overlooked in the discussion was that of yeast. To wit, using a low attenuation yeast, such as O2, can bring down the alcohol content 10 to 20%. For example, instead of using Nottingham, use O2, and that will bring down the ABV around 20%. It's a good trick if you're a brewer that's trying to do lower alcohol beers. Appreciate that, Mark. And Mark says, not sure where you stand on the debate, but I think drawing a line in the sand at 5% maximum alcohol meets a session beer requirement is a load of bull, Mark says. Me, I'm brewing for great-tasting lower alcohol beers. 5% or close doesn't seem to meet the spirit of lower alcohol, in my humble opinion. I think the session bar should be 4% and maybe 4.5%. Certainly, your iterations of rye wit all fall far below the 5% level. For those looking for a lower alcohol beer with great taste, I highly recommend the British Isles for guidance. A lot of decent tasting beers in the 2.5% to 4% range, milds, browns, ordinary bitter, stouts, etc. Well, thanks, Mark. I appreciate the tip and the thought. You know, back in my college days, back at during the Stone Age, at least in Arkansas, beers of 5% and above had to be labeled as malt liquor. So so maybe the line of delineation or the definition line for session beers is shifting over time. I can definitely see where you're coming from, Mark. But the good news is that as homebrewers, you know, we can make our own rules and then break them if we want to. Let's have a quick word from our sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. It's been a while since we've talked about the Build Your Own Beer feature of HighGravityBrew.com. It's pretty cool. Build Your Own Beer lets you select your ingredients from one page, including adjuncts, yeast, priming options, fruit flavorings, and purees. You can even name your beer. And at the bottom of the page, the site keeps a running total as you add items to your order. So if you're on a budget and you need to track that kind of thing, it's easy to do that. And that stays visible the entire time, so you can see what your order is coming up to. And if you're new to brewing or want to order a kit for a friend or a relative, the Build Your Own Starter Kit lets you customize the basic equipment kit, again, all on one page. And be sure to check out the electric brewing systems, of course, that take the pain out of propane. Check all that out on our friends, family-owned and operated, HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Now, as you've heard, Kevin Welch of Boom Island Brewing in Minneapolis was very generous in sharing his time with Steve and me and taking us around to some of the wonderful breweries in his town. This is the last of those interviews that were recorded up there. We had a great conversation with Evan Salee and Matt Houck, two of the founders of Fair State Brewing Cooperative. Okay, here we are at Fair State Brewing Cooperative. You guys introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Matt Houck. I'm one of the co-founders and the director of sales here at Fair State.
I'm Evan Salee, also one of the co-founders and the CEO.
And with me is Steve Wilkes.
Hi, James.
And Robbie and Kevin are in the background.
Hey. Hi, guys.
They're the live studio audience for this thing. I know. So Evan, since you are the CEO,
all right,
and you said that you were kind of the genesis of from the homebrewing perspective of this whole thing, do you want to tell the story?
Sure. I guess I'll start back with the homebrewing. So I've been big into craft beer since well before I could legally drink. I started homebrewing when I was 18 on a summer home from college, and I discovered that you could buy homebrewing ingredients without being 21, and thought that was a fine way to spend my summer. So
now we can't, from a legal perspective, we cannot advocate.
Yes, that is a terrible idea.
Misbehavior.
Yes, my youthful indiscretions. So that was, you know, has been one of my biggest hobbies for my entire adult life. Nico, our head brewer and third co-founder, who can't be with us right now, he was one of my roommates in college for part of it. We've been good friends for a long time, and we played rugby, which is how we met Matt. Matt played rugby for a different college. And so after we had graduated from college, me and Nico went to go watch a game between our two colleges playing each other and kind of saw Matt in the crowd, pulled one of those, "Oh, I remember you" kind of things. And we hit it off again and kind of eventually developed a kind of three-way passion for homebrewing between the three of us as like one of our big hobbies for those few years after college. And that's kind of when I think for myself, I definitely got a lot better and more serious about homebrewing, you know, now that I actually had a job and could afford to buy things. That definitely helped. So at that point, I think it was 2009, I guess, that me and Nico left town.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess I should know. I left town. I don't know why I'm looking at you. But, so at that point, so I went to move to Chicago for law school. Nico moved to Austin, Texas to go to grad school in American Studies. And then Matt stayed in Minnesota, but also to go to grad school in nonprofit management. And then, so we kind of all just scattered to the wind. Come 2011, we met up in Austin at for South by Southwest, and we were drinking beers at Black Star Brewing Cooperative, which was the first cooperatively owned brewery in the country, or at least consumer co-op. And it was kind of one of those light bulb moments for us. We had never seriously considered starting a brewery before, but it was, I think part of it was like making good beer. I felt like we had to do more than make good beer, and that was such a unique idea. And Minnesota is such a cooperative-centric place. We've got more co-ops than any other state in the country. People know it, and people understand it, and we could just sense the kind of community that they had down there, and we thought that would just work really, really well in Minnesota. And then the taproom bill was also about to kind of happen, and so we just kind of could see that Minnesota was such a strong craft beer community and how much stronger it could be once taprooms could exist. And so then, yada, 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 here we are.
Well, I think we're missing the important part.
Oh, yeah, the important part of Nico being a professional brewer at that time.
Even before he was a professional brewer, being a way better craft brewer than either of us. Or a better home brewer than either of us.
Took it far more seriously down in Texas than we ever did together. So he ended up, after he got his master's, decided not to pursue his PhD. So then he went and brewed for a few breweries kind of on an internship or a part-time basis at Southern Star and Jester King primarily. And then he moved over to Live Oak, where he kind of did his first really long-term, full-time experience as a brewer, and spent there pretty much the entirety of his career before coming up here to start this.
So, Matt, what is a brewing cooperative?
So we are a cooperatively owned company. We are considered a consumer cooperative as opposed to a producer co-op, and that the people who own our business are our customers, specifically people who are members and typically come into the tap room a lot. It's a similar model to a grocery cooperative or REI. So the actual product that we're selling is not brewed cooperatively per se. I mean, not in the economic sense. We have a head brewer, we have a brewing staff. Like, we do a few homebrew competitions a year, like one homebrew competition every year, a few member designed beers and things like that for the tap room. But for the most part, we're trying to make, we're a cooperative in selling beer to people. And so people buy in. The memberships are $200 for an individual or $300 for a couple with sharing a single vote. That's a lifetime. And those member owners elect our bosses as the founders. We have a 9-member board who really is...
Fired a lot of us.
Yes. Wow. And that 9-member board really sets a lot of the long-term strategic goals, strategic decision-making. For the most part, kind of let Nico do his thing, although we are now slowly starting to respond a little bit more to market pressure since we make more beer. It's no longer as easy as when we were mostly selling into a tap room and kind of made what we wanted. Although I still think we're trying to
make what we want.
Just the amount we make are changing. As a cooperative brewery, it's just been really interesting. When we were back in our homebrew days... And this was before, we thought it was a craft brewer explosion back then, but 5 years ago compared to now, it still seems completely different. We always felt like we wanted to know more about how the business of beer worked. Like, it felt that, like, breweries were this black box that we couldn't necessarily see inside beyond, like how it works from a business perspective, how it's different from a brewing perspective, what grain sourcing looks like, all of that. So we wanted to be able to start something that was fairly transparent and let people get a little bit more involved in that process and let people see how that all worked.
So in a way, do you get to use this structure to bring in people with more expertise in different areas of, say, marketing and sales and, all the structures of business?
Well, yes and no. So as Matt said, our members are essentially just consumers here. It's the people that come into the tap room, and they kind of have the freedom to make almost as much or as little of it as they would like. We have, we have well over 1,000 members, and the vast majority of them prefer to spend their time coming here and drinking beer and kind of being a part of the community without being, really, really deeply invested. But we do, try to provide as many opportunities for people to become engaged and just help out where they can. But that said, we try really hard to have a professional staff in every respect. I think it's really crucial if you're going to be able to make really good product, if you're going to be able to do a good job overall, that there has to be like that consistency and that commitment that you can kind of only have if that's your job. I think it's also really important that, like, because our members are our consumers, we have to provide them with a fundamentally quality and consistent product, and that's like our primary goal, because they are the people that drink the beer own the beer, and that, you know, that's what they need.
I mean, I do think one thing to the board structure certainly lets us bring in some outside expertise and have a lot of people, like, so on our board we have everything from people who are in arts management to people who are VP of sales for companies to someone who's deep into finance at a co-op, at like the largest co-op in the country, at CHS. Yeah. Like
lawyers, designers. We do have a good variety of people on our board, and our board is essentially elected democratically by our membership. So we do an annual meeting every year to elect. Now it's just three on 3-year rotations for a 9-member board, and so, you know, it's made up of our membership that is that board that governs the business.
So what is the philosophy of, other than the business structure, how do you approach beers? If you were to, you know, give the elevator speech to someone who didn't know anything about Fair State, how would you describe your product line, or how would you describe your brewing philosophy?
Keep it clean. Which is a funny thing to say at a place that makes a lot of sours. but I think is still something that's really, for the most part, I mean, we make a Hefeweizen, it's very popular, but for the most part, we make very dry beer. Beer with that finishes, that, I mean, attenuates a fair amount, finishes fairly low. We try to limit ingredients where it makes sense, while still exploring, like, fun hop varieties. Fun other stuff. I mean, we do some crazy things like smoked sours, but even with something like that, what we're really trying to do is produce these beers in a way that's going to taste good throughout an entire pour, and keep you wanting more. I mean, it's fun to go try a lot of different crazy beers, and we certainly are making some things, but, like, for the most part, we try to keep it. I mean, yeah, like, I mean, stuff that, how do you want to?
I think you're definitely there. In many ways, it's sometimes easier to think about, like, what we're not trying to do. One of my least favorite questions is when somebody comes up and says, you know, what's the sourest thing you have? What is the hoppiest thing you have? That's not what we're trying to do. That's not how we think about the beer. We're trying to, you know, make a final package that is complete. And completeness involves balance. It involves nuance. And if you're just trying to get the most something out of it, that you're not really trying to make a drinkable beer. And at the end of the day, we're trying to make beer that you want to drink. Part of it is, you know, you're sitting here at this tap room. We're trying to build a cooperative community around it, and you want to be able to sit down, have a beer with your friends, and enjoy it. And it's a lot harder to do that if it's, you know, a 12% sticky sweet beer that you can have like 3 sips of and you're done. So,
speaking of an approachable beer, this is the Pilsner. We've got a flight of 4 in front of us. You've been sipping on the Pilsner. What do you think, Steve?
I think it's delicious. It's really good. The word drinkability came up, you know, as you guys were talking and as you were approaching that. That was the thing that struck me about all of these beers. Just going right down the line. So I know you asked me about the Pilsner, but going to the Roselle, it's very drinkable. And I've had a lot of hibiscus-y beers that I didn't think were drinkable at all. And some by really big famous breweries and some by little, you know, 2-barrel systems. This is very drinkable, and I could drink a pint of this. Again, I've had a lot of them that I couldn't, although it might be a fun novelty beer that, oh, I'm proud I did this and I was able to do it. But it's not drinkable, and that's important to me as a consumer and as a brewer. So there you go.
Yeah, it's a tasty Pilsner. We just had the Pilsner from 56 Brewing, and it's similar but different. It's interesting. This is a teeny tiny bit, I want to say, sweeter, but maybe it's maltier. Just it's very drinkable. It's step mashed.
Yeah, we do with three. It's a three step. So it is a single malt, single hop, classic German Pilsner, Hallertau, Mittelfroh, and classic Weyermann Pils base malt. But it is step mashed, and I wish I could remember the temperatures off the top of my head, which I can't. but it's a three step mash. including the mash out. And what that does is it does help just bring a little bit more out of that, I mean, very classic Pils profile of the malt, and just get a little bit more,
cracker.
Yeah. It almost tastes like a cracker. A little bit of that. And it balances out really, because it has a rather large bittering addition. I mean, it is a 40 it's a 40 IBU, 4.8% Pils. Wow. So it's we're not messing around on the hop end, but it balances out really well. And we're definitely going for that very classic German Pils profile.
Yeah, it is very well balanced. And you wouldn't think that it's, you know, it's not overly bitter. Mm-hmm. But and I'm not saying that it's too sweet. I'm saying that in comparison to the one we previously had, it has a little bit more of a malt character. I like them both. But I'd love to see the different approaches from different breweries on similar styles. So no decoction, right? But a step mash.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's correct. No decoction, right? At least at our original brewery, we were not set up to be able to do decoctions. So at the new one, you know, maybe we'll try a new Pils with some decoction, but not yet.
Yeah, for a beer we make as often as we make that one, the three-step match is already a fair amount of work before we throw the decoction in.
Yeah, time-consuming and energy-consuming when you're at a larger scale. Talk about your brew house. What have you got going on in the back?
Here at the original tap room, we've got a 7.5-barrel system from Craveller. We double-batch everything into 15-barrel fermenters. We've got 5 conical fermenters, and then we've actually got 2 horizontal reconditioned dairy tanks that we also use for fermentation and conditioning. And so at the new brewery, then we've upgraded to, we've got a 4-vessel 30-barrel DME system, and then we've got 4 90-barrel conicals, and then 4 horizontal, again, reconditioned tanks for lagering.
So you're moving on up as far as
we are, hopefully.
Yeah, a little scary, but so far so good.
Pretty new to us.
Awesome. Well, what do we got here? This is the.
That's the saison.
Okay,
I hope so. I think that's the order that it's in. You'll do. DuPont.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's in this
that's
case.
A saison.
In this case, yeah, we're going to dry that out as much as we can. It was the goal of that. We use the DuPont strain for that. We used to make it with the 3711 strain, but we switched over to DuPont. Despite some reputation, especially on the homebrew community, of DuPont stalling out, we've never had an issue. We let it free rise. That ferments lower 90s usually. And it pounds through. Like, it is a quick ferment. We really like what the DuPont strain does with it. It does dry it out really well, brings out some nice esters, a little bit of spice, a little bit less of the bubble gum that you get from some of the other ends. And then kind of inspired by both things we want to do and some of the things happening with farmhouse beers elsewhere around the country, we really wanted to play around with American hops in it. And that centennial hop profile with the citrus, we thought, was just a really nice pairing with all everything else that's going on in that beer. So we call it DuPound, and it's kind of our play on DuPont with a little bit more of an American attitude, and really made as a beer for drinking. It's 5%, 25 IBU, very approachable, but has a ton of flavor. And love that beer. Wish more people would drink it. But that's the problem with saisons right now in Minneapolis.
What do you mean? Is there a are they prejudiced against a saison for some reason, or is it just not trending yet? Or
it's not an IPA.
Oh, okay. All right, I get it.
Call it that.
So it's a saison IPA. Farmhouse IPA.
We did call it a farmhouse IPA when we first made it, and no one believed us. So we decided to just be more honest about it and wait for everyone else. And luckily, there's a few other breweries making great saisons. I mean, you guys are hanging out with Boom Island all day, who makes an amazing year-round saison. So there's a few of us trying, and I think the market will eventually come around. It certainly has on the coasts, especially on the East Coast now, where you walk into these breweries and, like, they're complaining to me when I was just in Brooklyn last week. I was like, yeah, like, our IPA sells the most part. Like, the Saison just doesn't do that well. It only sells, like, two-thirds of what our IPA does. And I'm like, oh, sounds like a good problem to have.
Yeah.
What do you think of the Saison?
It's delicious. Again, I'm using that word a lot. I mostly get a dry black pepper nuance at the end, and it makes me want to get a steak. It's like this would be great with a good T-bone or something, you know. So yeah, and it's very dry, it's very drinkable, but that black pepper note really comes out at me.
Do you get and there's no spice in it, right?
No.
Do you get a coriander character?
There's a joke in there somewhere, but I'm not going there. Yeah, a little bit, sure. I mean, maybe you suggested it, but yeah, I get a little coriander. Actually, I would say cilantro rather than coriander. I get a little cilantro.
Oh, well, if you're English, you'd say, you say coriander's both.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying cilantro is the leaf, usually,
right, exactly.
And coriander's
right.
The seed.
Right.
I get a little bit more of the leaf flavor.
Interesting.
But it's not vegetal.
Right.
But there's a little bit of that, yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's very drinkable. I think sometimes saisons can be a bit challenging to me, just
yeah.
Because the yeast character is so prominent.
Yes.
This is nicely balanced, very drinkable, and well done. I drink that all day.
Thank you for the compliment. I do drink it all day.
So. You, maybe we should we move on to the, yeah. This is the pale ale, I think.
Okay, good.
So I haven't tried it yet.
That's
so
what
you,
I would have poured.
So
yeah, pale ale. I'm drinking
yeah.
it right now myself. So this is our pale ale. It is Citra and Simcoe in pretty much equal measure. Straightforward, straight up. All of the hops are put in at flame out. Really just heavy on the aroma and the flavor. Keep it really nice and balanced and just... tons of that Citra and Simcoe character to it.
Can we pause for a second?
Okay.
Sorry.
What do you? While they're talking business, the tasting room is open. Things are happening here, Steve. It's a hopping thing. What do you think about the pale ale?
It's really juicy.
Yeah,
it's really juicy, and it's good. It's not. I'm really impressed with how many beers we've had today, not just here, but that the late hop editions not. Doing the full 60 or 90 minute boil with the hops and how really hoppy the beers are.
Yeah.
And it's very nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to start playing with adding if not the bulk, all of the hops at the whirlpool or the late hop. So Evan, this is are all of the hops in that late stage and none at traditional bittering?
That's correct. Yeah. So we put in a ton of hops, and so we find that it's essentially enough to give you that bittering character to balance it out.
Yeah, I think it's great. Now I asked at 56, I asked Nick if you were a home brewer and wanted to duplicate this beer. You know, it's different on the when you get the big system and you got the whirlpool. Things don't, you know, they stay hotter longer than if you're at 5 or 10 gallons. If you were to duplicate this technique on the home brewing scale, what are some tips that you would give?
That's a great question. I think that honestly, I'd kind of give it a shot. It's been a long time, and I've never. In my homebrewing days, experimented with just doing flame out hops. That's only been since we've moved over here. But I think that if you just try to cool it down as quick as you can, or you could attempt to, I guess, put them in a bag and pull them out if you're a little worried about the over extraction of the bittering character to it. But I kind of feel like I'm shooting in the dark there.
So how long do you have an idea of how long the hops stay at what temperature for how long in your setup?
I have not brewed on the new system, and I am just not sure how long it takes there. Especially, I would imagine not terribly long because we actually now have a four vessel system, so we can pull it off the whirlpool much more quickly. So that would be my guess.
I would say that this beer, I love it. It's big and juicy in the hop flavor. I got a bit more bitterness from the 56, and it's unfair to you guys. I'm coming to you, comparing beers, but in that version, I got a little more bitterness. Did you think so or not?
It's delicious. Actually, I honestly, my palate's too confused. I don't remember. This one I think is juicier.
I think so.
Yeah. And so I don't want to say it's fresher tasting. That's not really what I mean. But it's just got that kind of juicy. I love it. Wow. I'm articulate.
I like both of them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting again how the approach it just makes a different beer. I would drink pints of both of them all day long. Now, you guys also do tart beers. Do you, where do you come down on, are you all kettle souring or so explain your approach to getting the tartness in.
Yeah, the one you've got in front of you is actually the only kettle sour beer we really make anymore on a regular basis.
In Cromulence.
It's not kettle sour.
Well, it's quick, yeah, hot anyway. Side sour. No, there's Roselle then.
Anyway, so...
we'll cut that part out.
It's not. What we do on the Roselle now is it's not quite kettle souring. So on our new system, we've got essentially a dedicated fermenter that's hooked up to our hot liquor tank so that we can hold all of the beer at temperature for the period of time that we need without tying up the brew house. So essentially run it through, boil... do you know really short, 10-15 minute boil, pump it over to the the souring tank. I don't know if we have a name for it right now. Leave it there to get the right pH, pitch, pure lacto, and then go back, boil, continue on like normal, pitch stays on yeast into it. So so we started off only doing kettle sours, not necessarily only, but those were the only things we had on because the other sour beers were taking a long time in the basement. We did a lot of experimentation with different kettle sour beers. We had our what's called our Lactobac series, which was kind of our first foray into the kettle souring. We did, about 13 of those. They were kind of all over the place, just, different experimentations in how to do it while we kind of refined our process and figured out what we liked. We do a ton of other, barrel-aged, more traditional mixed culture sours and things like that as well.
And stainless mixed culture sours.
We do that, yeah.
Which are, and we generally, and not mixing it, we do a little bit of blending with those, but less than we used to. But usually our barrel stuff is barrel fermented. We go straight from the heat exchanger right into the barrels. We didn't used to do that, but we started doing that, and it's just worked beautifully because those barrels now have gotten...
lots of funk.
They got, got all our funk. They got culture. Good yeast cultures in there. They got good lacto cultures in there. So they start to really do a good job. Some of them now are limited to just our smoked sours, but
yeah, well, hard to get the smoke out once it's in there, I imagine. Yeah.
And then we also started doing. We have at our new facility have a couple dedicated fermenters in a separate room just for stainless fermented sours. And then again, similar mix. Usually, we have a house lacto strain that we've isolated that we will grow up for those. For Brett, use a lot of Brett Brux Dre, and a little bit. What's the one that just got reclassified from Brett to Sac?
Is that the Trois?
Trois.
So, but we use a lot of different Brett strains, but I think, the Brux Dre is the primary one that we use, especially in a lot of the stainless stuff that we do. Our Lactobac that we've done most recently has kind of shifted then from a kettle sour to a mixed culture, but in stainless. And so, then that's, essentially, Sac, Lacto, and then Brux Dre.
And then we do a few beers that are just Sac and Brett. We do a Brett IPA, which is not 100% Brett ferment. It's Brett and Sac co-ferment, and a Brett Saison. So no tartness, just some funk. And with both of those use the little bit of the Trois and the Dre strain, which ends up just really nice and juicy and pineapple-y and like really like a little bit more on the fruity end of what Brett does than on the horse blanket end.
Nice.
Not that the horse blanket's not nice sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious. So as a home brewer, you guys are telling me that you're souring in stainless and you're souring in barrels. Tell me why you do one beer in one and one in another, and what is the difference that you expect between the two? So if I had the exact same beer, and I did one in the stainless and one in the barrel, what would be the difference that you would expect from that?
I think the primary reason we do it is kind of from a process perspective, more so than necessarily like an end result. The vast majority of the barrels that we use are, you know, what would be referred to as neutral barrels. So, you know, where the wineries have essentially, you know, just used them to hell and just there's no real appreciable oak character left. And we'll certainly get, you know, maybe a little bit of the wine character on the first use, but once we're past that, they're relatively neutral. But they're really good at, you know, absorbing the cultures and kind of everything good and bad that can happen from there. And so, you know, you'll get barrels that behave differently in different ways, and it's really difficult to predict. So there's a lot of value in there. You know, I kind of liken it to, you know, a painter's palette or something. You know, you've got these different varieties of barrels that have different flavors, and then you can kind of blend them and get what you want. Stainless allows us to, I think, have a lot more control over that process. We essentially start from the same place every time. So it kind of allows us to kind of start with a more fully realized conception of what we're looking for and then try to make it happen in that way. And then it also, you know, allows us to dump out that stainless tank and do a completely different beer in it that has a completely different profile, and we don't have to worry about the fact that we've just ruined that tank by doing a different beer.
It's a little more repeatable out of the stainless. So we kind of figured out some recipes we really liked out of the barrels, and like some of the stuff, I mean, it's really fun to do stuff out of barrels where every blend is going to be a little different, etc. But it's also sometimes like, okay, with like a Brett Saison and Brett IPA that we're going to be making most of the year, with a Berliner Weiss that we're going to make every year, we kind of want to have a little bit more repeatability. The stainless lets us start with the same mixed culture every time. That's hopefully it's going to mutate some, but mutating less than whatever's living in the barrels.
So let's talk specifically about this one, the Roselle, the sour saison with hibiscus. So you've got a kettle soured beer, fermented with saison yeast, and then you've got hibiscus in there. So how do you strike that balance? I mean, how do you get the hibiscus character in there? And Steve, you were saying that you've had hibiscus beers that were overpowering in the past, but this one's not. It's nicely well balanced. It's fun. It's fun. The three things work together very, very well. So how do you treat the hibiscus? How do you get it in there? Give us some tips, some hints.
Dried hibiscus flowers. Yeah. I'm trying to remember where this is.
We throw them in at Whirlpool, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's Whirlpool.
I've known a lot of breweries that, you know, throw them in a lot earlier in the process or leave them to steep in the fermenters. And I think that both of those processes can kind of pull too much from the hibiscus. I was talking to a brewer at Great American Beer Fest who was talking about like how he made a non-sour beer with hibiscus that was much more sour than a sour beer that he had made, because it does, you know, contribute some to that profile. So we throw it in there. We use this powdered hibiscus. It works really well for us. Gives us really great color and just kind of, you know, that more nuanced hibiscus profile rather than just kind of something that hits you in the face.
Yeah. It reminds me, bear with me here, this reminds me a lot of a dry French rosé wine. Yeah. It has a wine-like-ness to it. Of course, it's carbonated, so throw that out. But if you get past the carbonation, then it has that kind of summery, light, berry-like that you would expect in a good, I'm not talking about cheap rosé, I'm talking about really good good French rosé. This goes there for me in terms of where my palate is with it.
As far as I'm concerned, that's like the highest compliment you can pay that beer. That's kind of what we were going for.
Way to go, Steve.
Yeah, and
it's delicious, by the way.
The history of that beer is also interesting because it was the second or actually the third kettle sour we made, but the second in the series, in the Lactobag series that we were kind of experimenting with. And we kept on having requests to make it over and over again that we had to eventually give it a name. And then it was the second beer we put in cans. And now that is the beer we make the most of.
Wow.
So it was really important to have a separate souring tank for that to keep up with, or at least free up the kettle for other things.
Very nice. Now is that, you've got a bottle there.
I do. So this
I've been eyeing that bottle.
Yeah, this we're moving into the mixed culture territory. So this we call it the Grodziski. For these very pedantic homebrewers out there, it's, you know, somewhat less traditional because it is sour. But you know, we somewhat joke, tongue in cheek, call it the Polish champagne. Relatively low in alcohol. What do we got here? Yeah, 3.8%, 100% barrel fermented, 100% smoked wheat malt. And, it's, you know, fermented in the barrels that we use for, you know, the smoked beer that we use. So we also do our Lichtenhainer, which is you know, a similar beer. It's a little bit more alcoholic, and so we kind of do those both in these barrels, and it's one of our favorites. I mean, smoke and sour, we never thought that people would like it, but they do.
Did you say 100% smoked wheat malt?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to let you talk while I sample. Kevin's giving a big okay from the end of the bar.
That's mighty good. That's better than that. I like smoked beers and make them somewhat regularly, and I love the subtleness of it. I love the effervescence. I love the cleanliness of it. It's not like chewing on an ashtray. A lot of smoked beers are. Boy, it's just like the best campfire in a bottle. It's very nice.
What do you think, James?
The smoke is big on the nose.
Okay.
Sorry. I got smoke in my nose. The smoke is really big in my nose, and that kind of intimidated me at first. But then I tasted it, and it's nicely balanced. It's nicely smoky. But then when you're done tasting it, the smoke evaporates. It goes away. It's not a lingering acidic, you know, acrid smoke. So I think it's, there's a little magic trick in there.
And because of the wheat, it's kind of lemony as well. There's a little bit of a lemon note, and I think that's that wheat coming through.
Oh, with it?
There's a lot going on there.
Now let's see.
I'm gonna save some of that so I can sit and think about it for a couple of minutes after we quit talking. Okay, so you're a professional brewery, and this is 100% wheat beer. How do you guys do this without getting a big glob of glue in your mash tun?
Rice hull.
Yeah.
Tons of rice hulls. You could argue with the 100% wheat if you want to tell me that the rice hulls are contributing anything to it.
It's a lemon note.
Lots of rice hulls.
Okay, all right.
Because I can do 100% rye beers, you know, with my brew in a bag setup at home, but. But, yeah, okay. Well, and it's clear. You know, you would think of a wheat beer. People think of wheat beers as being cloudy. This is not cloudy. This is as clear as the Pilsner was.
I'm curious what the yeast is that you use in it.
So are we.
Well, you got the – it's in the barrel.
Sorry.
You got all kinds of stuff in there. Smoky stuff.
Yeah.
No, it's a good question because people might have missed
what are you going to pitch in there?
So disclaimer, neither of us have anything to do with brewing the sours for the most part and actually pitching anything. But I believe this is one of the ones that we use a powdered hefe yeast in. That it performs super well for primary in barrels.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, and if Caleb listens to this, he will tell me.
There's a lemony flavor to it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's lemony and it's smoky, which didn't sound like it'd be good.
Well, I remember that you made that 100% wheat beer last summer, I believe. You were playing around with that stuff.
Suddenly last summer,
and you were at the motels. And
nobody will get that joke.
It's a joke. Anyway, if you're a Motels fan, you'll get it.
80s reference.
That's right. So, but at any rate, that was that's where I remembered the lemon, because that beer was very lemony, and this strikes me the same way, except it's smoked and sour and more complex.
Wow. It's like a lemon pie kind of, the more I drink it, the more I'm thinking of like a lemon meringue pie kind of lemon character. Am I crazy?
Yeah, but you're still right.
Delicious. Man, that's awesome. And I would like to purchase a bottle of that, or maybe a couple, three to go.
Make that happen.
Yeah. Yes, that's awesome. Well, guys, Fair State Brewing Cooperative here in Minneapolis. Matt, Evan, thank you guys for your time and your hospitality and your advice.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
So thanks again to Evan and Matt and Kevin and Steve. I did buy two bottles of the Grodzinski to take home. What a fun and complex beer. Everything was very tasty at Fair State, or as Steve would say, delicious. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our log books where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all of those out at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that are purchased through the link are KitchenAid Spiralizer Plus Attachment with Peel, Core, and Slice, and Intermediate Steering Shaft Universal U-Rag Joint Coupler Lower for 2008 through 2012 Ford Escape Mazda Tribute Mercury Mariner. It's a very specific item. Thanks again, everybody, and remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links at basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.